This is a true story.
The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in Wisconsin and New York in 2017.
At the request of the survivors, the names have been changed.
Out of respect for the dead, the rest has been told exactly as it occurred. Better Call Fargo edition of the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the BM to my VM, it's Dan.
Good evening, Scott.
Good evening.
What's BM stand for?
BM stands for the thing that almost delayed our podcast by a few extra minutes.
Okay.
I kid. I had a whole bunch of things I was going to start with. I was going to say the Noah to my Vince or the Nacho or whatever. I'm like, forget it. Just BMVM. That's fine. Anyway, we are here. I guess this is our final Better Call Fargo edition of our podcast because we're going to be talking about the season finales of Better Call Saul and Fargo. And it turns out we're also going to talk about the last two episodes of Twin Peaks, but we're really going to be concentrating on the two finales more than anything else this evening. So, unless there's anything more you want to banter about, should we just get right to the first show or what?
Yeah, let's start this thing ablazing.
Thing ablazing. Perfect, considering the first show we're going to be talking about has a bit of that in it. And of course, I'm talking about Better Call Saul. Now, the season finale of season 3 of Better Call Saul was titled Lantern. It was written by Jennifer Hutchinson, who has written several episodes of both Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, and directed by co-creator of the show overall, Peter Gould. Okay, I think we're going to do this with both shows. Let's start with the ending first. And by that I mean what happens with Chuck in the finale of this episode.
Before we talk about that, do you want to play our clip from back in 2015?
Well, I like to say that we'd like to try to remember. What was it we were talking about way back in May of 2015? It seems like it was just 2 years ago.
And I just got one more point, and this is something that, it feels like they're really telegraphing strongly this time. But with Chuck, do you think, I think at this point that at some point he's going to burn his house down with all these camp stoves, because I think they've just, in this episode in particular, they had enough just little clues, and maybe it's, you know, they're just making it look like that, so it feels like it. But I mean, you got the one thing where it's just a close up with him with the stove, and then there's one where he lights one of them, or he's doing something with him where he turns the gas on one of them and just walks out of the room, and then he goes and has this big argument with Jimmy. So there's that. There's the fact that the doctor in an earlier episode suggested that, you know, for all I know, he could accidentally burn down the neighborhood, and the fact that Jimmy mentions that he left a few fuel canisters and stuff. So do you think that something like that's going to happen? Because I think they've definitely planted a few pieces there. And I was expecting the house to start burning in this frickin' episode just from when he lit the flame and then just walked away. So
So you're asking, do I think that's gonna happen in the finale or happen overall?
Yeah. Probably both, actually.
I absolutely think that's what's gonna happen. I do think that Chuck will eventually pass away, and that is the way I think it would happen, because, well, first of all, he never leaves that house anyway, and all the things you just mentioned. They're like the little hints and foreshadowings and whatever. That's why I even joke about him wearing that security blanket looking like a baked potato, because I keep thinking he's going to end up getting baked himself. And you know they'll find his body in the foil packet, of course. Yeah. But I do think that's going to happen. You know, I could see that being in the finale. I don't know. That would be rather powerful. I guess it's a good thing that I haven't looked online or anywhere to see if Michael McKean was slated to be in anything beyond the season. But then again, they may have been cautious and not allowed information like that to be revealed even on IMDb.
Right.
You know, God damn it, I think that's going to – you know what? Now I think that's going to fucking happen. Well, that's totally your call. I mean, that's excellent. I think that's a really good chance of that, and I will give you all the huzzas in the world if that's what happens.
And then it'll be interesting to see what does. And you know, you thought the episode might start with a flashback or flash forward, so maybe they will do something kind of like they did with Breaking Bad before, where they, you know, they just show something like that. And
you know, just... I think we may see Nebraska again. I really think we're going to see Nebraska again.
I would be very happy if we did. So,
by the way, going off the Chuck is going to eventually be incinerated. Idea, which I will buy into. If Chuck dies, am I incorrect in assuming that Jimmy's probably his next of kin? I don't know if they've meant, unless it turns out he's got some other siblings or parents still alive, but I'm wondering about, the money from the law firm. Who would get that if Chuck dies, or is it something? Does he have something else arranged for it? I guess
from the way Chuck's talk now, and from his obvious low opinion of, not high enough opinion of Jimmy anyway, I think I could see him having it just the let the law firm just absorb the shares. Everybody keep their jobs, you know. Bam.
Right. It could be also his last little kind of screw you to his brother by him not inheriting, you know, any of the shares or the money there, which would just be that much worse because. I was thinking about that because I started talking about his stake in that firm being worth, you know, like millions. Like, well, if you kill him, there has to be something there. And then I could see them having a moment where Jimmy thinks that he is entitled to something and then finds out otherwise. So that might be just one more kick to the groin for Jimmy. Of course, I'm assuming Jimmy would already be rather upset that his brother is dead. So.
Yeah, and would probably feel guilty, just because he'd been warned about something like that before, so he'd feel guilty for any, you know, collateral damage that I'm assuming would happen.
I will make another prediction on top of your fire prediction. The fire will start due to bacon fat. It will be bacon fat spilling on the flames of the oven that will cause that to happen. Because they keep talking about bacon every time. That's what's good. And you know, there's nothing better on a baked potato than some bacon.
Well, now, I gotta say it is pretty sweet that you you brought bacon into it, somehow knowing that we'd also be talking about bacon on Facebook at this time. So nice.
Yeah, when I was listening to that, I was wishing, man, I wish bacon fat had worked its way into the plot somehow. But all due huzzas and hurrahs to you. You were the one to bring it up and say it. I went along with it right away, but doesn't matter. That was your prediction. So 2 years in advance, over 2 years in advance, actually. We can plant our flag in the sand here, the quicksand it may be, that here at the STVD podcast, we predicted Chuck would be in a fire. We thought it might happen by the end of that season, but we still get mucho credit for that one, man.
Yeah, I'll take full blame for my constantly referring to all the lanterns as camp stoves. You can tell I spend like way too much time like out in the woods like cooking stuff. So like whenever I see fuel canisters like that, I just like I use them as stoves instead of lanterns. So I'm listening to it and it's like, God, stop saying camp stove, you fucking dumbass. But I just kept doing it. So yeah,
I was getting confused listening. It's like, wait a minute. Is he talking about the actual stove? He's talking about the lantern because I kept focusing on that, and that's been a big thing. It literally took me like a minute and a half to realize that no, he's actually talking about the lantern. He's referring to it in that weird pop kind of way that you Midwesterners do.
Yeah.
So back to the episode and Chuck. So We kind of knew that was coming, obviously not just for 2 years, but just the way this season was going. The fact that they titled the episode Lantern, and the opening scene was that little flashback of them as kids, and they really focused and zoomed in on the lantern in that scene. It was beyond foreshadowing. It was like really like hitting. Anyone who didn't see that coming just wasn't paying attention. It was pretty hitting us pretty much hard over the head, but I didn't mind that. But it was pretty well done, I would say, overall.
Yeah, I think they definitely showed that, like, anybody that's been, like, paying attention and thought something like this might happen, like, just like, hey, guys, this is it. This is how it's going to go down, like, right now. And, you know, I suppose they could have been, like, trolling us and, like, it wouldn't have happened at all. But they, you know, they're cooler than that, so, yeah.
So one thing I want to say, and, you know, not just about the ending, but about Chuck overall, because, you know, a lot of this episode was about Chuck, and although he's done some mighty impressive work throughout the season, watching an episode like this, if Michael McKean doesn't pull down an Emmy nomination for supporting actor, I don't know whoever deserves one then. Because
yeah.
I think what he did this season, what he's done with this character in general, but what he's done this season and what he's done in this episode is beyond award worthy. It's because it's always something fascinating when a character who, on the face of the character, isn't terribly likable. And we know that there's a lot of anti-Chuck people out there, and rightfully so. This isn't like Pete Campbell or some of our Mad Men conversations. I mean, Chuck is set up more often than not, especially this season, as a villain character. And his vindictiveness and his flaws come out in full bloom during this season with how he treats Jimmy, and no more so than that final conversation between them in this episode, which it's not the first time Jimmy's had a gut punch, I think, delivered to him by his brother, but this was, I think, the worst one of all. I mean, and it's an interesting moment because I believe it's kind of the last words he even says to him, pretty much.
Yep.
Pretty much.
Well, I mean, assuming that he's deceased, yes.
Yeah, and we'll definitely talk about that for a moment, absolutely. But it's an interesting thing here because he basically tells Jimmy, you know, that he's never really cared about him.
Yeah,
I don't know. Oh, go on.
Huh. Well, just for me, like, the thing that really, really, I mean, that was brutal in itself, but the fact that he made Jimmy McGill speechless, you know, he thinks about saying something a couple of times and then just ends up leaving, but, I mean, to make him stop talking and, like, not trying to, like, you know, explain himself, I mean, that's, like, I don't know if we've ever seen somebody that's made him just shut his freaking mouth, so that's just chilling and brutal and unpleasant.
Yeah, it was extremely unpleasant. I'm not sure if what Chuck is saying is entirely true. I don't think that's actually true. I don't think he genuinely doesn't care about Jimmy at all. Simply because, for the long and short, if he never cared about Jimmy at all, then he wouldn't care about what Jimmy was doing as far as being a lawyer or anything else all this time. It wouldn't matter to him because he doesn't care about him. So it's not an entirely true statement, but I think it's more born out of more recent events than anything else, and what's happened to Chuck as a result of his dealings and trying to deal with his brother.
Yeah, and it seemed that he felt a little bit of regret there, that he, you know, he realized he crossed the line once Jimmy left. And do you think that you know, that this, like, what he did to Jimmy, like, is what directly, like, pushed him over the edge here?
What pushed Chuck over the edge?
Yeah, yeah.
I guess to sort of echo something that Howard says in the episode, one could look at it as the straw that broke the camel's back, perhaps.
Yeah, there was a lot going on.
The fact that Chuck essentially got outfoxed by Howard, not realizing that the lengths that he went to would push Howard to do what he did. He never anticipated that Howard would pay him off out of his own pocket, essentially, and get loans just to buy him out, because he figured they had no choice but to keep him. And he was dead wrong about that. So you had that incredibly awkward goodbye scene to him at the law firm, where he So he's already not happy about that situation and where he can go from there. But perhaps the Jimmy scene is the last straw. I don't know. I honestly don't know if I want to make that link or not. I think story-wise and emotionally, it's an easy line to draw, but I'm not so sure. I tend to think it's also about his psychosis more than anything else. And the fact that, here's the thing, Chuck had gotten to a point where he had finally become, while still not a terribly self-aware person, he was coming to grips with the idea that what he had was a mental illness, not an actual physical illness, and just learning to try to cope with it and trying to beat it. And
yeah,
I think it just came back full raging here in this episode, and that
it's kind of like when somebody with a like an opiate problem, for example, gets over their crap, kind of clean for a while, and then all of a sudden they get too much of it and they can't take it. So he basically OD'd on his own freaking psychosis.
It's basically like a relapse. And what ends up happening is, well, first of all, it's as pure an homage as I've ever seen to the movie The Conversation, which, by the way, is actually on most days of the week I pick as my favorite Francis Ford Coppola movie. I put it over The Godfathers and Apocalypse Now and everything. It's like the perfect film school movie. So if anyone who hasn't seen The Conversation, you should see that movie. It's probably one of the only times you'll see a movie which is essentially a character study that's also incredibly tense and disturbing as well. But the thing that's famous about that movie, and spoiler for those who haven't seen the movie, so I'm spoiling the ending for you now, the main character, Gene Hackman's character, Henry Gall, is so overcome with paranoia, because he's a professional bug man, so to speak, the professional eavesdropper, you might say. And he's so sure that somewhere in his apartment there's a bug somewhere, and he basically rips apart his entire apartment. Every wall, every floorboarding, every shelf, everything, to the point where at the end he's laying there in ruins. And what they do here in Better Call Saul, it's essentially the very same thing. It's the very same thing. And you kind of wonder at a certain point, I know that Chuck finds those wires behind the shelf. Oh, but you know what? The meter's still working.
Yeah.
Part of me was wondering if that had nothing to do with the power running. And he just didn't make that connection or something. But it kind of reminded me of the way Walter White was obsessed in Fly or something like that as well. But so a couple questions. One might be more obvious than the other. So by the time we get to the end and what he does, is it a deliberate act? Do you think he does this on purpose?
Yeah, I got the impression that he just had, he was in somewhat of a catatonic state, and what was left of his mind was just you know what, I've had enough of all this shit, everything is pretty much done for, and he just, did what he could to, that was his last act of defiance against what he was going through, was him deliberately doing that.
Yeah, I agree. I believe this was not an accident. I believe this was a deliberate act. He was trying to do what he did. I think that last moment where he's looking at the log of the medications and then everything else that comes beforehand, it seems to me that after everything he's gone through and where he is, he has given up, because he's essentially at this point he's alone. He's totally alone in the world now, I think, because he doesn't have Howard in the law firm. He doesn't have Jimmy. He doesn't have his ex-wife showing up ever again, probably at this point. What else is there? And his reputation is still shot, So it's not like he can go. I don't know if he feels he can just go practice law or if he'd want to. So yeah, I do absolutely think it's a deliberate act, and which then goes to the second question, which, do we think he actually dies? I do. I think he dies. I think this is the end of Chuck. I think we may still see him in other forms, like flashbacks or things like that, but I think we saw the death of Chuck in this episode.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, they could do something really, crazy and bring him back, but I don't really see what would be the point of that. What would they do with him in the future? He's just going to be like, burned like, Dr. Chilton for like a season. Like, I don't think that's really going to be great storytelling for this kind of show.
Yes, and I know you want me to do a Verger impression. I'm not going to do it. Verger. Not for one listener.
Yeah, but no, this Chuck stuff was definitely, a bummer, even though half the time I don't like him, half the time I do kind of like, understand his perspective. But just seeing him go from like the point where he's like going out and buying his own groceries, which like he wasn't able to do for the first, 28 episodes of the show, then he's actually going out and like doing that. And that's the symbolism of he's like, doing like the one thing that he had to have Jimmy and Ernie do for him. And like, he's actually like finding a way to do it. And it's like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then just to go from that to, as far away from that as you can go downward, just really, really brutal.
Yeah. And again, although it's something that we kind of saw coming, I mean, clearly we saw it coming a couple years ago, quite frankly, it doesn't make it any less powerful. It doesn't make it any less interesting. But I think one of the definite pieces that had to fall into place in order for the transition from Jimmy McGill to Saul Goodman was going to be the loss of his brother. And I felt that had to be a complete loss. I would not have believed that Chuck McGill was still alive during the Saul Goodman era on Breaking Bad. I would never believe he could possibly be alive during all that. So there it was. I mean, I think the way the season was going, it seemed inevitable. It's an interesting structure to the season because in many ways the season hit its high point midway through, and then it's kind of was then trying to find its way again for the second half of the season. While still a very good show and we love the episodes, etc., but it did throw off the structure, the arc of the show a bit there. But at least Jimmy's arc. But still, I thought it was, for a finale, which I expected to be, and for most of it was proceeding in a very subdued manner. This wasn't like a high-octane finale. It definitely had a couple scenes that were, one that we're going to be talking about in a minute or two. But I appreciated that because I thought it reflects the show, especially this season. It's Better Call right. Saul is not. I think that's always been one of the differences between that and Breaking Bad. It's a bit slower a show because you're dealing with a different type of character, and the character at the core of this is still a person who's essentially a good guy who maybe does not so good things, but his quote unquote his heart's usually in the right place. Although the last episode or two, maybe not as much as it used to be. As opposed to, someone becoming, a drug kingpin. So, yeah. Speaking of all that drugs, another thing that we've been talking about and waiting for the last, I guess, season and a half or so, or however long ago it was when Hector first showed up on the show, we've been waiting to see how Hector Salamanca is probably going to end up in the wheelchair. I'm fairly certain we saw it in this episode.
Right.
So, what did you think of how they handled that? Because it seemed like they kind of had some of the things that we thought were going into it, but they did throw a little bit of a surprise in there as well, I thought. So, how did you like how they handled it?
Oh, I thought it was sweet, just the way they made it, super tense at the beginning of the scene, and then the way they just, they executed really nicely. I didn't, just seeing, Nacho's plan, actually worked. I wasn't really expecting it to go off so smoothly, so that in itself just was kind of jarring, because, we're not used to seeing, a Walter White plan going off without a hitch, or, any plan that these people have. For the most part, there's always something that happens that just really, to escalate the tension and to, make it more dramatic, I suppose. There's always some kind of, fly in the ointment. But here, it actually worked. So I wasn't expecting that at all. It was just cool stuff.
Yeah, the moment when Nacho's first approach, when he's first pursuing and approaching Hector, and the fact is that moment where I think he runs, and he, you know, runs like to hide behind a car because he's planning to try to shoot him at first. I think it's one of the first times you've seen that character kind of run like that. Although he did do some flips to get into the building at one time, but other than that, because Nacho, kind of like almost like a younger Mike, he tends to be very methodical. Actually, a lot of these characters are very methodical now that I think about it. Mike is very methodical. Fring, of course, is very methodical. Nacho is very methodical. Interesting. But what was really interesting was that Fring was there. I hadn't anticipated that he would be present for what happens to Hector. And the fact that he actually tries to perform, or he doesn't try, he does perform CPR on him, that's an interesting choice. What did you think about that? Because there's that moment I think, well, Fring could just watch him die here, but then again, we know he doesn't die. But the fact that Fring tries to save his life is very interesting.
Yeah, I just figured, you know, he's trying to keep up appearances, so, you know, instead of treating Hector like his enemy, you know, since Balsa is there, kind of like, this kind of helps sell Fring's, like, you know, Fring's just, you know, he cares about the business, he's doing what he has to do, he's not making it personal, so him jumping in and does that, I think really kind of, you know, fits with the way that Fring is portraying himself to Don Eladio and Balsa.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I think Balsa has to get the hell out of there pretty quickly. There's also the idea that Fring wants to really be the one to bring Hector down himself, as opposed to letting something like this be what does it. I don't know how much truth there is to that or not, but it's an interesting way to look at it, because it's one of those moments, you know, you think, hey, you know, if you don't give him CPR now, maybe several years down the line, you don't get blown in half or something.
Right.
But I thought it was really it was a scene I was kind of waiting for. We were almost like, yeah, like rooting for it to happen, because Hector Salamanca has always been a rather easy to hate character, and they just made him much even worse in this season of Better Call Saul, especially with, you know, the stuff with Nacho's father and everything else. So,
the you definitely could tell with the scene with him and Nacho's father earlier that, like, you know, yeah, if we're thinking that they're going to wait and let this, like, you know, play out for a few more episodes into the fourth season, they're not going to be able to do that anymore. It's you know, it's go time. And, you know, Nacho realizes that, and of course we realize that at the same time.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
The scariest moment there is when Hector says to Nacho that he doesn't trust him after that. Because usually, if it had been anyone else, usually when it's like, I don't trust him, that's almost like code for he's got to go. And it's his dad. So you realize at that point, that's probably why Nacho at that point, you know, it's not about waiting a few weeks and letting it ride out. That's why he's got the gun, because he knows he's got to get rid of Hector, you know, sooner than he even thought he had to.
And Mark Margolis, I mean, damn, like the moment where his expression changes when Nacho's dad tells him to get out of his store, it's just like, holy shit, like just instantly, you know, went from like, you know, fake jovial to just like, just chilling, just an instant reaction, and it was really impressive to see. I thought,
yeah, I mean, Mark Margolis is a great villain, and I also like that during the final scenes with him, even before he starts to have his episode, his seizure, or whatever you want to call it, there's when he's just when he's first getting angry and he's cursing and everything, you can already see the twitches, you can already see the face. The face that we've come to know in the later years of Breaking Bad, and I was like going, oh, that's interesting. I'm seeing the grimace there. I'm seeing the eyes pop out again. I haven't seen that in his character really that much on the show until now, and we know that's really how he's going to end up looking more often than not for the rest of his life. It's also interesting that they had this whole thing play out with Hector and, you know, Nacho and Frank. And not to have Mike there. I mean, Mike was not in the episode at all. That was a very unusual choice that we wouldn't get Mike at all in the episode. But I guess there really wasn't a place for him here.
No, that's the cool thing about Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul is they didn't just write in one scene of him going on a date or something like that just to have him in the episode. They're just okay, this does not belong here. We're not going to put it here. Mr. Banks, you may have the week off. Here's your paycheck anyway. Enjoy.
Right. So, why don't we switch over to the other side of the show, which would be the stuff that was happening with... I'm sorry? Something else you want to say about that before we move on?
No, I think we've covered it mostly. The Chuck stuff, the scene where, Howard kind of arches him, his walk of shame out of HHM, I thought that was a really effective scene, too.
Oh, I thought this was probably one of Howard's strongest episodes, by far.
Oh, yeah.
By far. Patrick Fabian really got something to work with. I mean, he always does, but I thought he was really strong in this episode in his dealings directly with Michael McKean and what he does. Because, Howard's been putting up with this shit for years, and I think when Kim called him out on everything in a previous episode, I tend to think that kind of hit home a little bit. And
yeah.
Because I think that's what that might have helped lead to the decision to ask him to leave. I'm not saying it was the only thing, but that maybe one thing, maybe that was the straw, so to speak.
Right. So yeah, we can talk about the rest now. Yeah.
So Kim, when last we left her, she had that horrible car accident. So we have her with Jimmy in this episode and her deciding to scale things back. And, I mean, she's just, you just like her so much. And, I mean, I'm not even going to cite any specific moments with her in the episode. If you want to, I think you should. But, I love them going to Blockbuster. I love her talking about To Kill a Mockingbird, which really shows the different ways that she and Jimmy look at life and look at the law, by the way. I thought that was very interesting. But somehow, I think watching Kim in this episode and knowing that one way or the other, somehow these two are going to have to go their separate ways eventually, I'm looking at Kim in a more tragic way than I have before. I mean, and we've always liked her character. We always know these two are, something's going to drive a wedge between them. But I just felt so much more aware of it in this episode. Maybe because all the other things that are holding Jimmy back from becoming, from truly, quote-unquote, becoming Saul Goodman, it seems like Kim's the last thing right now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't expecting, them to spend so much time doing that this week, but I guess it's nice that they did, just, showing her, what she's going through after her accident. And, from the way they're doing it, I didn't know if her and Jimmy were still going to be together by the end of the episode. So I was a little surprised at how, she kind of, reaffirmed their relationship, somewhat in this episode. Because it didn't, definitely didn't, her in shock definitely doesn't seem like she's into Jimmy shit at all. But, he was doing his thing and, they're still together.
Right. Well, it's interesting because Jimmy tries to find... Because Jimmy's need for redemption is really redemption in her eyes. I don't think Jimmy cares about what anyone else thinks about him at this point. He might have he cares about what Chuck thought about him, and we see where that led. So I think Kim's the last straw. That's why so she's fully aware of everything he did as far as the trying to get the Sandpiper money and what he did with the old ladies, which is probably the next thing we should... Oh boy, we should talk about. So he basically realizes the only way to pretty much undo the damage he's done is expose himself as a money-grubbing fraud to all these people at the old age home. And I love that he gets the what's her name, Bree Brill. Can't remember the character's name. Sorry. This is what happens when I didn't take notes for the show. The lawyer from Davidson Man, the female.
Yeah.
I love that she came back because I loved her character last season as well, to help facilitate the whole, them overhearing the stuff he says into the microphone, whatever. But She doesn't even need to say at the end everything I said was true, because we know that already. We know everything she's saying is right. She, not only that she believes, mostly kind of true just in general.
But, yeah, it was nice to see her again, Erin Brill. I don't know if we talked about it before, but I listened to part of the Insider podcast. I haven't got through it yet, but I don't know if we talked about it in an earlier season, but I didn't know that she had been on Mr. Show, like, back in the day with him, so that was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, she appeared a few times. I've gotten so used to seeing other people from Mr. Show up on all these other shows, I sometimes kind of forget at this point. But that's right, I forgot about that very briefly, but yeah, she was on Mr. Show. So by the time this is all over, we're wondering what's going to happen, you know, next season as far as the impact. If we're going with the idea that Chuck is dead, and that's my way of looking at it, at least. I think it's yours too. How does that push Jimmy? What impact is that going to have on the Jimmy McGill character as far
and on Kim?
Yeah, there's the guilt that Kim will have as well, which she's had ever since that hearing is what, and whether in any way it will be erroneously he will be erroneously blamed for it, because I don't blame Jimmy for it, because it was Chuck's decision. These are choices, you know, that were made. Actually, is Kim the character who says at some point in this that these are, you know, these are choices that we make? I made the choice,
right? Because Jimmy's trying to take responsibility for her accident. She's just like, hell no, I'm the one that worked like a zillion straight hours. Like, I did this for myself. It's not all about you. And, you know, it's true, you know?
Right. I mean, I'm still thinking they have to do... See, it's tough. I still believe the show is going to need to do some sort of form of a time jump. So we don't have 10 months of Jimmy not being able to practice law or something. But by the same token, I can't see them picking it. Well, I mean, they could pick up several months after the fire, I suppose, but I guess they could do it either way. It could be picked up several months later, or they could pick up the show, you know, the very next day. It's hard to say with this show. I just feel they're going to have to do that. Then again, they still haven't announced whether it's been picked up or not, but AMC's got to be picking the show up for another season or two. I can't imagine that it's not going to continue. All right, so since we've talked about a lot of the different aspects of the finale overall, I think there's, let's just get to like the two big questions I think we have, you know. And the first one would be, you know, so how did we feel about the finale overall?
Well, I would have to say that I'm very pleased with the episode that we got. I don't think there was any weak spot, and I thought they really just maintained a nice level of tension and in a few different ways this week, because, you know, the different storylines that were going on were all their own thing. But, you know, seeing Kim go through her, getting her, you know, PTSD, I guess, and, you know, Jimmy basically, you know, fucking himself with the elder law stuff, plus the, and then the Chuck and the Nacho stuff. I mean, it was all completely different stuff, but none of it didn't, you know, felt like it didn't belong. It just kind of, you know, just flowed together nicely. They wrapped up some stuff, and we got some stuff to think about for the future. So I'm happy. Very good. Perfect.
Yeah, I was a pretty good fan of the pretty big fan of the finale. It gave me everything I wanted. It knit together or gave us separate storylines that I had, if not an equal interest in all of them. I was interested in every storyline to what some extent or another. I wasn't like, oh, let's get to the other thing. But beyond plot and tension, we got some great character stuff. The Chuck stuff especially was really strong. I mean, if he's submitting an I think actors either submit one or two episodes when they're going for an award, this would be one of the ones I would think that Michael McKean should be submitting. Maybe the one with the hearing would be the other one, I suppose. But really strong work. It's it's easily as good as the previous two Better Call Saul finales that I can recall. But I was very pleased with it, just as you were.
Yeah, just a great show. At some point during the episode, I don't remember what point it was, but I was just thinking, I'm just like, this is why this is my favorite show. Like, this is just awesome. And that's just how it is. That's true.
So if you were giving it, like, not that we have to do this, but if you were giving it, like, a letter grade, are you giving it, like, an A, or...?
Yeah, I'd give it an A, you know, an A plus. It would have to just be completely insane for me to give it an A plus, yeah. But you know, A still means perfect, just like perfect without like, you know, delicious frosting on top.
Only because I want to be a slightly harder critic, I'll give it an A minus, just to give it just a bit more room for improvement. Just because,
okay,
even though there wasn't room for Mike, I still miss not seeing Mike. You know, A plus is like, you know, the end of season 4 of Breaking Bad or something like that, Face Off or something like that. But what about the season as a whole? I mean, so now that season 3 is over and done with, looking back on the season, and they made some interesting decisions, which, you know, some might not have worked as well as others, but especially when we're comparing it to the previous two seasons, what did you think of the season as a whole?
I think it's, you know, just as good as the first two seasons, probably better than, you know, probably a little bit better than the first two. You know, I think with this show, it doesn't really have growing pains, but you definitely can, it seems like it might be getting a little bit better each season. So I think it might be, you know, kind of like that, you know, three A's for me, but I think this one might be, you know, just a little bit better than the last season. I don't really, you know, people do criticize it somewhat, whatever, but whatever their issues are, they are not my issues. I do not have any issues with pacing or anything they're doing on the show. They're doing a marvelous job in front and behind the camera in every single way, and they could have an entire episode where they just, like, you know, Jimmy paints his office the entire episode, and I'd be completely, like, riveted by what I'm seeing. Plus, you know, I mean, if I can put it with Twin Peaks, there's, like, nothing, like, Better Call Saul can do, like, in pacing-wise, like...
But maybe some people like watching someone sleeping for several minutes while Green Onions is playing, I don't know. I don't want to get into other people's opinions outside of this podcast, although I do that all the time anyway. I would just say, like, the pacing of the show has been fairly consistent for 3 seasons now. So anyone, I can't imagine someone complaining about it now. It's like, really, what was it, a roller coaster ride the first 2 seasons? Not really. It's proceeded at a certain pace. There are certain shows that are like that. And I've said it before, that's why, and I hate that I'm repeating myself, but people have made the same comments about a number of other shows I watch, whether it be Mad Men or The Americans, The Wire, or any number of other shows.
Yeah,
it feels like there are some segment of the viewers of any show that maybe what they're craving are more action shows, and these are shows, yeah. these are dramas, but they're not necessarily action shows. They're dramas that have elements of action at times, but they're also shows that are very talky. There are a lot of scenes that are just people talking to each other, and when that's the case, that's the way you're pacing them. I mean, people get tricked by tricks that people like Aaron Sorkin does. It's like, oh, it's just going to be 2 people talking, but I'll have them walking the entire time, so it feels like it's moving faster. It's like, no, all they do is walk from one side of the White House to the other, but it's still 2 people talking, idiots. Although those are great scenes, but yeah, I'm just saying.
With Better Call Saul, I think there's like 3 kinds of viewers. There's like you and me, who just like, we like our Mad Men and that kind of show, and we just like, you know, we're fine with what they're doing as long as it's good. We're not really gonna, you know, we're patient. We're able to do it. There's another faction that, you know, they really like the show. But they kind of think, you know, wish they'd pick up the pace a little bit. And then there's the people that like think Jesse Pinkman's name is spelled IE and they can't wait for him to show up in the show. Those people are so fucking stupid that you know they make the people that are impatient with the pacing. They're, you know, those people are heroes in my book compared to these other douchebags.
I wasn't expecting that. That's pretty funny. Lastly, my opinion on the season. I'll make it quick here. I feel like it's pretty much in line with the previous two. I don't think there was any downturn in quality which we might say about other shows, maybe even on this podcast, maybe. The only issue I had is what I had mentioned earlier, is the story arc or structure of the season was a little off, where it felt like it peaked midway through, even though the finale is great and whatever, almost like a tentpole kind of a situation there. I'm going to agree with you. I'm probably going to put it just a hair above the previous season because I love the introduction of the Breaking Bad characters, but in a way that really made me more interested than I thought I would be, and more interested in how these stories are going to unfold over the next seasons or years, whatever. And I thought they did it in a very fun way and real way, as opposed to forcing it or just paying. I mean, every once in a while you could say, oh, they're just doing fan service there. But I never really felt that as much with this show. I felt even when someone did make a brief appearance, it made sense. It made sense to have Huel in that one episode because he needed to hire someone who could, plant something on his brother. So it was a great opportunity for him to use that character. As opposed to just running to someone or seeing Lydia pop up a couple times, but it makes sense. As opposed to someone just making a cameo out of nowhere, where they which I think is a problem of the whole, Jesse or Walt, whatever. It's like, oh, they could just, make them look a little younger and show up somewhere. Like, there's no reason they would really factor into the story. I mean, I guess there is a way you could come up with Jesse at some point in the future. And then they'd have to do some video magic to make him look younger. But I don't need those characters to show up. I think the only regular character on Breaking Bad that I could see making a decent case to show up at some point would be Hank. Because at least I could see there being a member of law enforcement, the DEA thing, whatever. Especially, that I could see there being an excuse to see him pop up somewhere. But right. I see no way to get Walt or Skyler or even Jesse, despite his drug stuff, because he's too young at this point.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, at some point, if there's a time jump, you could have something where, Crazy A could be bitch slapping Jesse for some reason, for doing whatever. I don't fucking know. They could, mix that into it as Nacho's like role grows. You could see more of like what's going on around him, but. I just don't need it. I like Aaron Paul. He's awesome. And I had this discussion with my mom yesterday. Just like, I don't know if I want them ever to show up. I don't know I respect the show creators enough where if they do it, it'll probably be good. But I'm still worried that it might be, just a little bit, just won't feel right. So I don't know if I really need to see that at all, ever.
Yeah. I agree.
Before we wrap this up, I think I'm sure we both think the show is going to get picked up. Do you think right now they're doing one of those things where, like, when they announce the next season, they're going to announce how much more they're going to do of the show, like when it's going to end, that kind of deal? Does it kind of have that kind of feel to you?
I think it's very likely they'll do that. I think if they're going to get renewed, they may say we've been renewed for two more seasons or something like that, and so they'll have like an end date. So I'm going to say yes. That seems likely. It's not. It's hard to say because it's supposed to be like 2003 on the show now. So there's a whole lot of years between that and when Breaking Bad is. So that they could go on longer if they wanted to. But I think after two more seasons, I don't know if there'll be that much more to do. Because then at that point, he really will be just Saul Goodman. Where he becomes just kind of a soulless comical character at that point again.
Yeah.
So I don't know if they would go too much longer.
Yeah, and I'd like to see, maybe another two seasons and then a final season that, AMC will make them split into like, two 7-episode things a year apart or something. But I could see there being, enough story left where they can do one more 10-episode season and then another a split final season, and that would be, what they'll do. The more the merrier, but we will see.
Yep. Okay. Well, now that we've covered the finale for Better Call Saul, now it's time to get into Fargo. Well, the season finale of Fargo was titled Somebody to Love. It was written by Noah Hawley himself and directed by Keith Gordon, who I've mentioned a million times has directed episodes of this show as well as pretty much all the other shows that we watch. So, hey, once again, let's start with the ending. That final scene between Gloria, who at this point, and the show's had yet another time jump, I will note, they did two time jumps this season, very funny, between Gloria and Varga. I always forget, is it Varga or Vargas? Because it seems like they've said both. Is it just Varga? Dan?
Sorry, I muted myself. It's Varga, but okay. I called him Daniel Rand because, you know, this is really Iron Fist.
I don't know what that means.
Danny Rand, Iron Fist, the comic book character.
Right.
He calls himself Daniel Rand in the when he's being interrogated by Gloria at the end.
Oh, okay, I didn't catch that. All right. I was like, okay, did we just lose the podcast? I don't know what the fuck's going on right now. Okay, so the ending. What did you think of that ending?
I found it very interesting. I'm not really sure what they were doing there with certain things, like how dark everything got over Varga's face and stuff. But I have no complaints about it. It gave me stuff to think about. I'm not really sure what happened next or what even really happened. But it. It just kind of had just a really weird, strange vibe to it, and I guess I can see why people would be, to know exactly what happened. But it's been years since I've felt the need to have an exact, non-ambiguous ending. I tend to like having to do the work myself and not knowing if I'm right or wrong, and it's kind of like Schrodinger's cat, where I may be right, I may be wrong, but there's no way of knowing, and both possibilities are true. And I kind of like how that's, there's, no wrong answers, unless people are just being dummies about it, because then they're wrong.
Okay, I'm going to try to use my remarks. I'll try not to say anything that refers to any of our possible listeners or anything else like that. Here's my feeling on the final scene and how it plays out. First of all, the show had to end with a confrontation between these two characters. It had to come down to these two. Because more so than anything else, if you have, when we recall him saying in an earlier episode about there being good and evil in the world and so on and so forth, on this show, he would be the most, he would be the manifestation of evil on the show, and she's good. She's the manifestation of good, right? So I love that, even though it looked like he probably had gotten away with everything, whatever, still 5 years later, quote-unquote, she gets her man, so to speak. And we have this scene between them, right? Now, notice that he's spinning tales again. Not just about who he is, but he's telling all these stories and all this stuff. I love that for the first time in the entire series, someone says to him, "You're making that up." Because she says it to him, you're just making that up. Because what has been the overall running theme of this season that they keep playing with is this being what is truth? What is a true story? What is fact? What is opinion? And it's Noah Hawley kind of really, in a very interesting way, commenting on what's been going on in the world and in society and in this country specifically over the last year, where things that on the face of it we know are lies are being accepted as truth, and we're not sure what is true or not. And that's been a running storyline, not storyline, theme throughout the season. So we don't know. So we spend a lot of the season not being sure of things. There's still things to this. By the end of this episode, we're not sure of before that last minute. We're not sure what really happened in that bowling alley. We're not sure what the connection was between Yuri, the Russian hitman, and the Yuri who was the supposed murderer, so many years ago, where it couldn't it on the face of it, couldn't possibly be the same person, but he's treated like the same person in that bowling alley, as though the spirit of this other character was in him or something. That's never made clear to us, and we just go with it. Because that's where the show almost most closely resembles Twin Peaks for a moment, quite frankly. So when you get to these last moments where both characters have their what they think is going to happen in the next 5 minutes, who's going to come through that door? Either he's going to be quote unquote saved, and then she'll never see him again, or he's going to be taken to Rikers. I love the Rikers and Snickers bars; it's great. So it's kind of left. And we're focusing on that door. And yes, I love the way it's shot because it's done in a very deliberately stagey way where, like, with him going into silhouette, it's done more like a stage play than an actual TV show or movie would be. I love the use of lighting there because it's so very evocative. It's not just noir. It's just something that just... It's another way... It's another element of telling the story as far as I'm concerned. I know that I don't want to comment on other people who've watched this. I understand a need or a desire for completion and resolution. And I would say that one thing people should remember is, even though the Coen brothers aren't really all that involved in the show at all, it's still, you know... it's still inspired by and adheres to the Coen brothers' philosophy. And Coen brothers' movies quite often don't end with much resolution. Go try watching No Country for Old Men and get back to me about having a satisfying resolution to a story. That's a Best Picture nominee movie, whatever, blah, blah, blah. This, however... It gives you two options. It gives you, the viewer, two options. And I will confess what happened to me when I watched it. When I was watching it, and I'm watching the clock, I'm realizing what I think they're going to do right now, and I'll admit it, I was actually saying out loud, "Don't you fucking do this to us. Don't you fucking do this to us." And then when that credit came, I'm like, "Oh, you did it to us." And about 3 or 4 minutes later, because I was, taping it as I'm watching it, I rewound it back to the 5 years later point, and I rewatched the last, last 10 odd minutes of the episode or so.
Yeah.
And when I rewatched it, and I rewatched it like minutes later, I became really happy with the ending because I was watching it closely. And it's funny because... Many people who listen to this podcast, not everyone, but many also are fans of The Leftovers, which also had an ending with Carrie Coon, which had a certain level of ambiguity to it. Whether you choose to believe this or that. Oh my God, they did it in Fargo. You can choose to believe this or that. But they do something that's really kind of cool here. And a lot of it is about what's happened to Gloria's character over the course of the show and where she is in her life 5 years later. That at the end, while he kind of looks and it goes dark on him, right? But our last lingering shot on her, she looks pleased. She's kind of smiling. Because she seems to be confident that she's right. So the way I look at it, it's like choose your own adventure, so to speak. Those books that we had when we were kids, some of us had a certain age at least. And I think it's almost like if you choose to think that the world is a certain way, and again, how often in the series did they comment on the world? Whether it's the heartbreaking thing that Sai says, or there's things that Emmett says, or there's things that she says to her son, or there's things that Vargas says. It's another one of those running themes throughout the show. Anyway, the point is, if you choose to believe, if you've given up hope on what's going on in the world and on what is truth and what is real and what is good, then you're probably going to say, yeah, he's probably some guys are going to come and they're going to and he's going to get away with everything. But if you want to believe that there's still good in the world, you know, as he talked about in the previous episode, if you want to believe in hope or faith or any of those kind of things, then you're going to think, yeah, he's finally going to pay for his crimes. He's finally going to go away for this, even though some of those crimes he actually didn't commit. But whatever. So I really like that. I don't find it to be as maddening an ending as maybe people found the end of, say, like The Sopranos was, or things of like that, because that's the first one that comes to mind, quite frankly. I was very pleased with it, especially considering everything else that had happened in the episode, which we're going to be talking about right now, I guess. But I will admit, I needed to go back and just rewatch it immediately thereafter. So that's my one little asterisk. But beyond that, I was more than fine with the ending, and I am happy to discuss at length with anyone who didn't, and we can debate or talk about it. It's all a matter of opinion anyway. But I feel like this, to a certain, the story that Noah Hawley was telling this entire season, it made more sense to end it this way than to have it definitely be he gets taken to prison or he gets away with it. I thought that was the way it had to end, that it had to be, you know, for us to try to determine, just like the way we have to determine what is true or not in life, as well as on the show.
No, it's the kind of thing where, you know, the more I think about it, the more I enjoy what they did. There's certain little touches that they did that I appreciate, like as they zoom in on that, you know, small window in the door at the end, like instead of like feeling the need to do like, you know, have show a shadow or something like that, just to like, you know, kind of like the top at the end of Inception, they didn't feel like the need to like, you know, give you some like some extra visual to like, you know, distract you a little bit as you try to like, you know, figure out what happened. They just, you know, showed you the door, let you think about it. If you, you know, if you didn't like it, you didn't like it. If you liked it, you liked it. And but I like it. I can see why some people would be burned out by ambiguous ending, and why other people would just be like, you know, oh, this is it's lazy. I shouldn't have to do the work for you and fill in the blanks, blah blah blah. I can see why, you know, there's been a fair amount of TV and movies that have done that kind of thing. So, you know, I could see why somebody, if they watch way too much shit, they could get tired of that kind of thing. But I personally, and you as well, aren't tired of that thing yet. As long as it's well done and not just done for like, you know, to get people talking on fucking Twitter, we're I'd say we're both okay with it. And, you know, we're okay with people that, you know, are a little burned out by some of it too, I guess.
I have to be, because I'm actually friends with a couple of them, but everyone else can go fuck themselves. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. Maybe I'm not. Okay, so let's talk. Those people who know I like, who I care about, they know who they are. They're in the red circle. Anyway, extremely inside joke. A couple of our listeners will understand, and no one else will know what the heck I'm talking about. Let's talk about some of the other really great stuff in this episode. Nikki and Mr. Wrench, that whole sequence, and all the stuff between them up against Varga and his men, I thought that was fantastic. I really thought that was fantastic.
Very, very nicely done. Very good, you know, super tense scene. I mean, I was just on the edge of my seat, you know, metaphorically, because I was just kind of laying back and relaxing, but I was mentally on the edge of my seat.
But and they do something which is so interesting here, because usually when you're watching a scene and you're feeling tension, and you're, because when you're feeling tension, that means you have a level of concern, whether it's conscious or subconscious. But we're experiencing the tension through characters that we hate or love to hate, so to speak. You know, we would love to see Varga and his men, you know, shot to death, whatever. But we're feeling so much tension, not knowing when or what might happen there. The staging of the kid leading them on through the street and the cars moving slowly, I hadn't seen anything like that. I love that they took something which could have been done in such a cliched way. And at a certain point in time, it's hard to do that and not be like, oh, I've seen that before. And they still found a different little twist on it. I was really... My only regret is not actually seeing Mimo get killed, because I kind of, after all the stuff he's done, I kind of wanted to see it happen. But
yeah.
But other, and also, like, really? Vargas get away? How the fuck did Vargas get away? And I realized, oh, then I realized he's the God of War. But anyway, spoiler for something I shouldn't have said, but no one knows what I'm talking about. Who cares? But yeah, I loved all the Nikki Vargas stuff and the fact that even, you know, that Nikki and Mr. Wrench are still a team at this point was really great. I enjoyed that tremendously.
Yeah, that ended up, you know, if let's say, you know, episode 2 or 3 of the season, somebody had told us that, you know, a Hitman character from the first season was going to end up teaming up with this, you know, bridge playing, you know, attractive, tall human female, like, you know, like, and it was going to be awesome. Like, there's no way we would have fucking like bought that, but it worked really, really well. They managed to, you know, do that.
Yeah, I was. It was well choreographed. It was well put together. Yeah, I mean, I was extremely satisfied with how they pulled all that stuff off. But then you get the scene between Nikki and Emmett on the roadside there, that whole thing, and that was a tough scene. But again, Emmett and Ewan McGregor really kind of finally made that character something worth watching the last couple episodes, because I don't think we certainly didn't care about Emmett at all in the first half of the season at all.
No,
I mean, I think it took him accidentally killing his brother to even give a damn about that character, what as far as I'm concerned, and then he finally started being interesting. But the scene between them on the road, I thought that was really it was, I mean, other than it being obviously a really good scene, but it was interesting because Nikki starts to repeat the thing that Ray Wise told her to say in the bowling alley. But part of me, I was bothered by that, actually, because I felt she was saying it to the wrong person.
Yeah.
I felt that was that speech, and because the idea was that she would be confronting, like, you know, the epitome of villainy or evil or whatever. That's not Emmett. I mean, yeah, Emmett did, to whatever extent, kill Ray, but we know that you know, he didn't. It wasn't like premeditated murder. It genuinely was an accident. Even if he believes that he's been killing him for the last 30-odd years since he screwed him over as kids.
I mean, yeah,
that speech should have been said over Vargas, not over Emmett, I thought.
Well, I suppose maybe it was an act of bowling alley gods that you know, sent a police officer there to interrupt her speech, and that was just saying, like, you know, whoa, you know you got this wrong.
Yeah. What's interesting is when you have, and then yeah, when the trooper shows up and how that all plays out, it's also a reminder that although we're totally rooting for Nikki during all this, you know, as far as getting back at Vargas and you know, outfoxing him and so on and so forth. At the end of the day, Nikki's not a good. It's not like Nikki's such a good person herself. She has killed. She's killed before this. I mean, her way of resolving the problem with her and Ray from the very get go was to kill a guy. So, you know, she's not the most moral of people. You know,
And I wouldn't say Emmett deserved to die for his actions. He just, you know, he got caught in some crazy crap too. So I wouldn't have cheered if she gunned him down there.
No, I was trying to figure. I kept thinking she's not going to. What's going to stop this? How is he going to? I was wondering how they were going to write their way out of this, where it would be fulfilling. And then when the trooper showed up, like, oh no! And I knew. I mean, I knew it was going to happen at that point. Although I didn't know it would be the pure, you know, cartoonish duel, like where they both shoot each other, you know, bang bang like that. It was sad to see Nikki die, because she ended up becoming one of the MVPs of the season, but by the same token, I think she kind of had to. I didn't think Emmett was going to die, although that changed 5 years later. Let's talk about that for a minute. Did you expect that, when the 5-year jump and then him to get killed? that kind of came out of nowhere for me. I mean, I thought it was really cool, but I was like, oh, it's so horrible because, you know, like, you know, one of the kids or his wife is going to come in and find him like that. It's just, it's a horrible way to go.
Yeah, you know, when I think back on the episode, you know, it made sense of something that would happen, but I wasn't expecting it at all. So it was brutal.
Yeah. But, the only thing more brutal than that is seeing what's become of Cy Phelps. I mean, I'm glad he hasn't been in a coma for the last several years, but poor Cy. You know? I mean, he looks like he's in pretty bad shape, and it looks like that's going to be his existence from that point on. It was fascinating, the stuff that happened with the IRS agent, and when Gloria comes to see him. The thing that I thought was really interesting was when he, and not that he lays out everything, you know, plastering the entire conference room and the table, and still in an anal retentive, you know, perfect way. The fact that, generally speaking, outside of the tax issue, everything that they were actually doing was technically legal. And I was, like, amazed by that, because we assumed that those were all about money laundering and blah, blah, blah. And it turned out to be, no, they were just doing, they're engaging in business practices, which people do to kind of screw people over for money. And if they had actually paid their taxes, they would totally, it would be legitimate. They wouldn't, it was all, just like Al Capone, it all came down to taxes. I also did not expect Mrs. Goldfarb to be part of the scheme. That was a bit of a surprise.
Yeah, I was kind of expecting it somewhat, but I wasn't really sure, like, you know, what place she had in that organization. But I wasn't too surprised about that. It just kind of felt like, you know, I mean, why would this person be covering for Emmett, you know, unless there's something else?
Oh, yeah. I didn't thought of it that way. Yeah, that makes much more sense that she would cover for him then. Yeah. That makes way more sense. I'm so dumb. And finally, going back to Gloria, I do like that by the end of this, that it feels like she's finally found her place in the world, because she seems like she had been kind of a lost character throughout the series, you know, whether it be her being invisible to technology, which she finally got rediscovered by in the previous episode, or the fact that she was able to, although she was about to resign and then didn't, but obviously she clearly eventually did. She just looks happier, and that's even before she's told about that they got this guy, it turned out to be Varga and everything else. So I kind of like that she has a little bit of a, and that's why I will choose to believe that he is going to be taken to Rikers, because I like to think that Gloria gets her bit of a happy ending. Kind of like, doesn't the robot get a happy, eventually get a bit of, after all that tragedy, get a happy ending at the end of that sci-fi story back in episode 3?
I don't remember.
I think he does. Okay. Yeah. Anything else about the episode specifically before we just talk about give our general opinion on it?
Well, we're not sure if they're going to do another season of this yet. I did think that, you know, seeing Carrie Coon as a Homeland Security officer, you know, did get my wheels spinning a little bit, where, like, you know, I could see them maybe doing, you know, using that in some fashion in the future. You know, Minnesota is on the border with Canada, so maybe they can put, you know, some kind of story together and, you know, use Carrie Coon somewhat and, you know, maybe figure something out. I don't know. But it did make me think, just like, oh, you know, there's probably, I could, you know, there are stories they could still tell that take place in this area that could be interesting and different. You know, it doesn't always have to be cops.
Yeah. I mean, I think Noah Hawley has said, after previous seasons that they, you know, he doesn't know if they have any more stories to tell, and then they come up with another one. So I'm not so sure there won't be another season of Fargo. I tend to think there will be. Until we're told definitely otherwise, I will choose to believe we will get another season. And that's that.
Yeah, maybe not for a couple of years, which is fine. You know, do a Kick-Ass season of Legion in the meantime, and you know, take a vacation and then come back with something awesome.
Yeah, write another book maybe.
Yeah, that was a good book. I enjoyed it. Quick read, but it was good.
All right, so let's get to like those two questions that we had, just like at the end of Better Call Saul. So here, overall, how did we feel about this finale?
Well, I went first last time, so why don't you start us off this time, sir?
Okay. I enjoyed the finale. Again, I had to rewatch those last few minutes just to really, for it to really sit well with me. But beyond that, I felt it was pretty much, for the most part, very well paced. A significant amount of tension in a number of scenes. You can't fault the acting on this show. David Dulles is so much fun to watch as Varga, and Carrie Coon is always fun to watch, etc., etc. And I really enjoyed it. It's kind of like I'm talking about the finale, but I kind of want to. It's hard to talk about the finale and not talk about the season as well. But I'll stick to just the finale for the moment. It's a better finale than I would have expected based on the first couple episodes of the season, if you know what I mean. What was your take on it?
Yeah, I'm basically in the same boat. I thought it was a really nicely constructed episode, and my attention was thoroughly occupied by it during the entirety of the show. So I thought they, did a nice job here. I think there definitely were some very memorable scenes from this finale, as there were in the last, the last episode of the last season, for example, and just a variety of different stuff. So while this season in itself may have been missing some of that, I think the finale it was a good way to close out the season in a way where it kind of helped, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, let's just talk about the season as well now. We've been very upfront about the fact that we, especially in the first half of the season, we were kind of like, eh. And again, it's not that the show wasn't a quality show. It's not that it wasn't, there weren't good things about it, but our issues were, there was a couple of major issues with the show, especially in the first half of the season. Number one, kind of felt like they were going to the same well over and over one too many times. Too many things felt like repetitions from previous seasons and didn't have that spark to them that they did in seasons one and two. So it just felt like they were more repeating themselves as opposed to, that's a Fargo trope. Instead, it was more like, oh, they're doing that again? Kind of a thing.
Yeah, and it might have felt like that because the story itself at that point in the season was kind of weak too. So, we had more time to think about the stuff that the similarities, because there just wasn't really a lot to think about at the time.
Right, and let's not forget what also will hurt the show to a certain extent, maybe minor, but if you're watching season three of Fargo, generally speaking, that means you've watched seasons one and two. So in your mind, you're also automatically comparing them, and so you're instantly going, "Oh, this isn't kicking off the way the previous two seasons started." Because those, I love the way that both seasons one and two started. I mean, quite frankly, I thought they were amazing. And the other problem I think we had with it, and I think many people had with it, were the Stussy brothers at the core of the show just were not interesting or compelling characters the way the similar characters were in previous seasons. They weren't 1/100th as interesting as Martin Freeman's character was in season one of Fargo.
No, or Kirsten Dunst in season two.
Right, exactly. And Jesse Plemons, who at least were more both interesting and also sympathetic, at least he was. Maybe not her. So that, I think that hurt the show a lot as well. But putting the third episode aside, because the third episode almost exists in a different universe than the rest of the season, quite frankly, I think. And I don't just mean because it was in Los Angeles. And I love the third episode. You loved it too, didn't you? the whole Los Angeles?
Yeah.
Yeah, that just, yes. it's so out there, I just loved it so much. But putting that one aside, because it isn't technically in the first half of the season, I think for the show to really, to get moving, and to start being something that we enjoy, really genuinely enjoy looking forward to watching and talking about, was once they kill Ray. Once they kill Ray, all of a sudden the show kicks in, I thought. All of a sudden, Emmett finally becomes a tragic figure as opposed to a hapless dope that we don't care about. Because now I actually feel bad for him, whereas before I didn't. Before that, all we kept talking about, I don't understand why he didn't just go to the police. I don't understand why he can't just get out of this. And now it becomes about that. And I think that's what was missing in the first part of the season. They needed a crime or something to have happened that really would have grounded those characters more and made us care about them. I didn't care about Emmett or Ray ever until after that. So the show really kind of reversed engines and changed course for the better, I think, in the second half of the season.
Yeah, slow start, but overall, you know, by the end, I think we're both relatively satisfied with what we got. And I think we can say for the third year in a row that this season of the third season of Fargo was better than the third season of True Detective, which didn't fucking happen because the showrunner fucking shot his load in the first season and then nobody fucking loved him anymore. So, sorry, fuckers, but...
I didn't expect that to be said either. I'd also say it was better than season 2 of True Detective.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no. I mean, obviously, even based on what I just said and how we've talked all season, yeah, we like the first two seasons more. I mean, for me personally, I would, you know, first season's an A, season 2 is an A+, because I like season 2 just a little bit more than season 1, because I got a better ending for the character resolution stories. This... probably going to be a B, because
I'd give it a B. I can't quite give it a B+. You know, it's not bad, but
no. It
just doesn't measure up and when compared to the other two seasons.
But at least there are standout episodes, and it did get better as it went along, as opposed to the opposite. Better that a show end well and start badly than start great and then suck at the ending. Because then you feel like you just wasted your trip. At least by it ending well, we feel, okay, we don't regret investing the time that we did into it. So
for this season, Fargo, it, you know, definitely didn't feel like one of the top tier shows. But in the end, I'd say, this season was kind of like, you know, an uneven episode of Justify would be, where like it's still a good show and like some really cool stuff happened at the end. But, you know, it was worth watching. We don't regret watching it. No. You know, maybe next season they'll be better.
And oddly enough, I think for me personally, I think what's going to happen for me is that Noah Hawley's other show, Legion, is likely to take the Fargo place in my heart for the year. So when we get to the end of the year, Legion might be one of the leading contenders for one of my favorite shows of the year. This season of Fargo, no, it's not. I mean, it might. If I do a top 10, it might make the 10, but it sure as hell ain't making the top 3 or 4.
Yeah.
Okay. So we are going to try to squeeze in a little bit of time here to talk about the last couple episodes of Twin Peaks. Okay, we skipped Twin Peaks last week because you hadn't gotten a chance to watch it as of yet, I think, when we did our last podcast. Was that the reason, I think?
Yeah, I've been watching with one of my friends, and there's an issue with their showtime, so it just by the time they got it going again, it just wasn't working out with our podcasting or my work schedule, so I ended up doing a doubleheader on Sunday and watching chapters 6 and 7 together Sunday.
I'll tell you, I'm probably going to be more appreciative talking about part 7 than part 6.
I figured you would.
I mean, I'll tell you right now, part 6, and people out there are like, I don't know which episode of part 6 was. Part 6 was a couple weeks ago. That was the one where I was really starting to get a little the Dougie stuff was really getting tiresome at that point for me. I think the most notable things in that episode, was our first time we see Diane. And I think anyone who knew that Laura Dern was going to be on the show would have guessed that she was going to be Diane. I guessed that, and I don't know why I thought it would be her, except for her close connection to David Lynch to begin with. So I figured, you're going to get Laura Dern to be on? I bet she's going to play someone significant. I was like, oh, it's going to be Diane. We're finally going to get to see what Diane looks like. But what all, that was the episode that had like Harry Dean Stanton in it for, I wasn't really sure why, you know, other than it's Harry Dean Stanton.
Well, he's in Firewalk with me. He's the he runs the mobile home court where where Teresa Banks lives. The first like person that, you know, the killer kills.
I have no memory of Firewalk with me, so I'm at a disadvantage there. Okay, now, at least I know why he was there. I guess fine. And then we had all that stuff going on with Benjamin Horne's kid who ends up running over a kid.
Yeah,
which was pretty horrible.
I'm not sure if it's actually a kid in a kid, but I said that for certain. You know, he's a little young too. So I mean, you know, it could be his kid, but I mean, Ben's got to be in his 70s by now, and this guy doesn't seem much. This kid doesn't seem much older than Audrey did back in the day.
Oh yeah, but people, you know, guys in their 60s and 70s can still be having kids. So. I'm assuming it's going to be his kid until we hear otherwise. So that's my guess. What the heck? Oh, then we had that whole thing with the little mini psycho killing people with. I thought it was an ice pick at first, but then I realized I think it was an awl. It looked like it was killing people with an awl.
Yeah, I think it was an awl. Yeah.
I didn't know what to make of that. I mean, he does. I mean, one of the people he kills is the woman who I think was trying to kill Dougie in a previous episode, or behind the people trying to kill Dougie in a previous episode. I didn't know. Other than it being kind of like freaky, I don't know.
Yeah, it was brutal and it was strange, but it, you know, I'm sure there's some reason for it that we'll never know.
Right. Well, that's the show for
it. But it certainly was entertaining and had some it created some weird shenanigans and lots of blood.
By the way, I do recall, because I had written notes for that episode like a week or two ago, and then we didn't do it. I will tell you right now, one of the notes I had written down was about Hawk finding the paper, those documents or whatever, in the bathroom stall door. And the note I wrote was, oh God, please don't be missing pages of Laura Palmer's diary. And of course... That's exact, and of course now when we see it, it makes perfect sense, and it had to be that. But at the time, I was just like, oh god.
Yeah, but I suppose in hindsight, you're probably like, okay, they're talking about that, then you know, then just have it be like something completely random that has nothing to do with anything.
Well, let's just focus on the most recent episode then, because that's the one I just watched that today myself. I was able to sneak in and watch it. The latest episode was actually one of my favorite episodes since the Dougie phenomenon first happened. Because obviously that's been bothering me. But I think a lot of things happen in this episode that really were either fun or interesting or really got me going. And even the Dougie stuff didn't bother me as much as normal. Especially what happens when that little mini psycho attacks them out on the street. So, was he Cooper for a moment there? Because that's the way I took that he kind of snapped into Cooper mode.
Yeah, he definitely seemed to be, channeling those abilities, because I don't get the impression that Dougie Jones ever had that kind of training.
You don't think Dougie Jones normally like moved like a cobra?
Hell no.
He was like a cobra. I love that line from that lady.
It was cool to see. It was a fun scene. And, you know, I personally am enjoying the Dougie stuff. I haven't found it to be boring or whatever. I laugh out loud at a lot of the obnoxious stuff, and I haven't got sick of it yet. You know, I mean, we haven't seen Dale Cooper for 25 years. When I watched Twin Peaks for the first time, and you know, I don't know, 8-9 years ago when the series ended. I'm just like, with the way it ends, with you know, Bat Cooper smashing his face into the mirror, I'm just, and me thinking that was going to be like the ending, for, and I would never like know what happened after that. Right. Like, I can handle waiting. I can handle waiting a few more weeks and having him, you know, get just like stand there while the elevator door closes on him, or like just completely like not understand what's going on at all. I haven't got sick of it at all yet, but I definitely, you know, I did think that the second episode, part seven, was, you know, doing more stuff. It just kind of felt like Mark Frost was like writing it more, like, especially reading the book that I just read by him. Just like, oh, like, this is like more, maybe a little bit more Frost, less Lynch this week than
that could be it.
Than,
yeah. I think for me, I mean, I probably just don't have quite as much patience as you do. And maybe it's because I really adored Agent Cooper so much when I watched Twin Peaks. I mean, I love Kyle MacLachlan's cadence of the way he spoke and everything. I haven't gotten to hear him speak that way again. Because we haven't, I mean, his I don't remember if he's had hardly any dialogue when he was in the lodge that was really, did he really speak when he was in the lodge?
He's had a little bit.
Very little.
Yeah.
Because you know that he has a very distinctive way of speaking. And I don't feel I've gotten to hear that, and I'm kind of missing it, you know. And they're Lynch and Frost. I blame them both in a way. They're taunting us because they keep doing things which you think, oh, that's going to be the trigger, and then it's not.
Yeah,
that's going to be the trigger. Then it's not. Everything from the coffee to the badge to you know the files, and now someone attacking me goes, and it still hasn't been it.
I don't mind that, because like Lost, like if it was the fucking Lost flash sideways, like, yeah, you take a drink of coffee and then you're gonna be like making out with like somebody you just like realized you love like 5 seconds later. So I don't mind him just like taking their sweet time and just, you know, making you think like, oh, this is gonna be it. Nope.
It's driving me crazy. It's driving me fucking crazy. And the fact that the evolution of the tree thing shows up too, which was just. How does that not register as something in his brain? What was it? It was like, squeeze his hand off. What the what the hell was that about? Was the evolution of the tree evil? Because that's like a horrible thing to say. But then again, the mini cycle is kind of a little thing of evil. I don't know. But I really enjoyed this episode that much more because we also got, you know, we got a healthy amount of different storylines that we were interested in.
I mean, the Dougie stuff was kind of fun this week, and I enjoyed Naomi Watts just talking, not like Dougie would be able to get a word in edgewise, but just completely like steamrolling everybody that she gets in any conversation with whatsoever. You know, so I'm assuming that, you know, she'll go away when, you know, Dale comes back. So I'm enjoying seeing that character, even though it's really over the top. But yeah, there's, you know, a lot more stuff's going on this week. The stuff with the diary pages I thought was really cool. The stuff that's going on with Major Briggs's body and whatever, like that, like guy walking around in the basement there, like creeped the fuck out of me. And
was a really weird shot. I kept going, what's that about?
I don't know what they're gonna do. But whatever they're doing, it was an effective shot. So that's, you know, and that stuff kind of ties into the book too. So, you know, if you're into Twin Peaks and you're liking the season and you haven't read the Mark Frost book, just buy the fucking book. The you know, the Secret History of Twin Peaks. It's cool. Yeah, but go ahead.
I'm not gonna advocate anyone going out reading a book for the damn show. But I will appreciate they did something which I hadn't expected, by getting those diary pages into the story. They did a healthy amount of exposition there to try to connect the dots of what happened, you know, whether it be 25 years ago or whatever, for people who, like me, didn't go back and rewatch everything or read everything, and we might have forgotten certain things. So I was kind of happy that they did that. Another episode that has a rather sad thing in it, so, you know, kudos to them for doing it, but also kind of sad at the same time, because we briefly saw Doc Hayward on Skype with Frank Truman there, and that is yet another actor who has actually passed away already.
Yeah, Mark Frost, father, Warren Frost.
Warren Frost, right. Yeah. So that was kind of... So there's a lot of this, like, it feels like we keep seeing people on the show who have already passed away, which is makes it almost more eerie in a way, because it's at least three or four characters now who are watching or have seen who have already passed away.
Got right.
Got Log Lady, you got Doctor, got Albert. I bet there's got to be another one in there. I'm just not thinking who it is right
yeah.
now.
Yeah.
So that's three. That's still kind of, that's more than you ever see on any other show we ever watch.
Yeah. Other than Babylon 5, when like half the actors fucking die after the show.
Well, that's, I don't want to talk about that. So, also, the stuff with, first of all, I mentioned Laura Dern before. I loved the Diane character.
Yeah.
I love the fact that Lynch and Frost go, hey, we're on cable. There's one thing we can do a lot we couldn't do on ABC. So every word out of her mouth is fuck.
I assume they probably just like, you know, at least Frost, or maybe both of them, they got the idea from listening to our early podcast episodes, and we would just like tell each other to fuck off at the end of each episode.
Oh my god, I forgot we used to do that.
It's been a long time.
It's been 190 podcasts. I can't. Oh my god, 190. But yeah, I think that's how we used to end them. That's right. Wow, oh, good times. But what really pushed that story forward was her going to see Dark Cooper or Evil Cooper or whatever we want to call him, and just the realization that they all know, like, okay, that's not just something off. That's not him. I also love them working in the whole thing that he had actually said, you know, very backwards, because that was one of those things that, you know, a lot of people didn't realize when they were watching the episode, myself included. But thanks to one of those little articles online, BuzzFeed or whoever had it, where they showed that he said a word backwards and then forwards, kind of. But then Lynch going through the trouble, or Gordon, let's call him by the character name, of the fingers for each word and how it was the spiritual finger. That's why it was reversed. And the fingerprints are reversed because of it was all gobbledygook, but I really was like, I'm really enjoying this. This is just because it's crazy and insane, but I'm actually feeling like there's a certain logic here. And I'm talking about Twin Peaks. That's crazy. Now it feels like that key's not going to mean anything. That got sent back to the Great Northern. It looks like it's not going to mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely, I mean, I'm not sure what they would do with that, but I'm assuming, you know, Ben Horne's received that key, so maybe that'll continue to do something, or... I'm assuming that he just, like, throw it in a desk and then just close the drawer, and they would do, like, that kind of shot if it was, like, this doesn't mean anything thing. So I'm assuming that he's still carrying it around, that it'll have some, you know, maybe he'll go visit Audrey, assuming she's still alive. I don't know. Maybe that'll play some kind of catalyst, because we haven't seen her yet either.
Yeah.
I'm assuming she's still alive.
Well, I like that they mentioned her, because then that gives us hope, like, oh, she must be alive. Maybe she's alive, since they mentioned that she was in the hospital as opposed to being blown apart, which I think she probably should have been.
Yeah, hopefully she's in better shape than Sai after her coma.
God, right. But the stuff with then with Evil Cooper getting out of prison, basically blackmailing the warden over something about it. Am I crazy? Was it about a dead dog or something? What the hell was that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. You know, I think something to do with the dog and something to do with the guy. Maybe an inmate. I don't know what the deal is. So I'm sure they'll never go back to it unless they end up, you know, giving the warden some crap about how he got out. But I don't, you know, I don't know if I need an explanation. I just, the Evil Cooper definitely, you know, he pretty much hacked the, well, not hacked, but like accessed the information on the prison, and, you know, obviously went in with an escape plan. So, you know, they did some really cool scenes with him locked up, and I'm fine with him being out and, you know, able to cause shenanigans now.
Oh yeah. I'm just wondering how the warden's going to explain to the feds that he got out. That's good. That'll be a fun one. But yeah, I mean, I like the fact that they pushed several stories forward. I'm of the camp that I'm wanting the Dougie stuff to end sooner than later. But you know what? I enjoyed the Dougie stuff in the episode, so it didn't make me angry. Other than the tease of, oh, he's out of it. No, I love that he keeps grabbing for badges all the time too. I think that's
yeah. And whatever he was doing, like, you know, looking through those insurance fraud like
case files or whatever, and I'm just like, well, I don't know what the heck they're doing, but it's entertaining. So I think we're probably going to have, you know, two or three more weeks of Dougie, because they don't really seem like they're quite ready to get him back yet. But I think they're getting there.
Well, at least one thing with Dougie is that now, and correct me if I'm wrong, while he's been in Dougie mode, two things from the Lodge have appeared to him, though, correct? Because we had Mike in the previous episode, I think, right?
Talk to
him, like, wake up, don't die. I was going to do it in backwards speak, but I decided not to. And now it seems weird to call that the evolution of an arm or whatever the hell it's supposed to be. I.e. the replacement for the little guy.
Yeah.
So I was like, so let me get this straight. You know, all the Cooper triggers aren't waking him up. Two different things from the Lodge haven't woken up. So now I think we don't have time tonight. Maybe if indeed Dougie still doesn't wake up after the next episode and we talk about it on a podcast, we should start trying to predict how exactly does he become Cooper again? Because now it's going to have to be something just totally out of left field, I think, at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I have, you know, no idea what they're going to do. So, I don't know.
And did we really need to spend all that time with Benjamin Horne and Ashley Judd trying to figure out where the humming was in the room?
So. Yeah, I don't know. I thought that was really creepy. I don't know what they're doing with that either, but it definitely, you know, I found it to be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought it was just, I was just trying to piece together whether there was some sort of creepy agenda on Horne's part as far as she was concerned, because he seems like I seem to recall him being a bit of a horn dog, no pun intended.
Yeah, you know, yeah, she kind of seems like she wants to bone down. He's just like, you know, whatever, go home. I'm not feeling it anymore.
And then she goes home to some guy who looks like he's practically an invalid or something.
Yeah.
Should I know who that is, or he's someone we don't know?
I don't think that's a character we've seen before. He seemed vaguely familiar, but it's probably just an actor I've seen somewhere. So, no, these seem to be characters we haven't seen before, and I'm not sure how they play into it, but they're definitely just, you know, They're parsing out these new characters with no barely any explanation whatsoever, and just letting us stew about it as we just something to think about while we watch somebody sweeping up the roadhouse.
I got to make a confession about that sweeping scene, and I mean, I like that piece of music, Green Onions. I've heard it a million times. Howard Stern used to use it like as background for commercials for like 15 years when I used to listen to it way back in the day. It's always been a favorite piece of music of mine. But once I realized they were doing their, we're just going to see how long we can let the scene go on for where nothing is happening, I actually hit fast forward on at my friend's house, and I was astonished by really how long it was going on for. I was like, are you kidding me? I was just watching that pile, and fast forward watching that pile, you know, of stuff that was debris he was sweeping up get bigger or whatever. Very silly when they do stuff like that. It's there's no reason to do the stuff like that other than just because they can, because they're
yeah, no,
you know, it's silly.
I kind of liked it because, you know, like for most of the first six episodes, it's ended with a music number.
Yes, I thought
done
that.
At the roadhouse.
Yes.
So in this case, it was just an instrumental, you know, number after everybody, you know, presumably had left. So, and I've enjoyed the different kinds of music that they've been playing at the ends of the episode. I'll probably actually buy the soundtrack when it comes out, which is not till September, but it is available for pre-order. The soundtrack with the soundtrack with these various songs that are playing at the end. Not that they're titled yet, because I suppose that's spoilery, but like, you know, I guess that's just how they chose to end this one. But yeah, I mean, you know, I just sat there watching it, and it was like, you know, like when you, like, it was like watching a screensaver.
It's exactly what it was like. It was a screensaver. Yeah. It's exactly what it was. Yeah, I like the music at the end. It kind of reminds me of the kind of thing I might, you know, the latest CD at Starbucks or something like that. But it's fine. But I would say that, yeah, again, I was not a big fan of part six, but part seven kind of really, I enjoyed part seven a lot. This latest episode really kind of brought me back from the edge of being like, I'm losing my patience with the show overall. And I'm like, okay, you gave me a little bit more to go with. You introduced some characters I kind of enjoyed. Gave me some more storylines I care about. So it's not just one thing, although it kind of still really is one thing. I think it's renewed my faith a little bit. We'll see if I feel the same way after the next episode.
Yeah, now that you say that, like, part A is just going to be, like, you know, Dougie and Sonny Jim just, like, you know, clapping the lamp on and off the entire episode, and nothing else will happen, and you're just going to be like, fuck.
No, it's going to be Dougie just, like, we're going to see him in the bathroom just playing with a toilet paper or, like, a cat or something, because I'm still trying to figure out, if we've seen him, he has issues with urinating, how they handle that? Because Lynch strikes me, he will go there. We've had enough urine and vomiting on this show, so why not? Not that I want them to go there, but it would not shock me if they did.
Yeah, but hopefully Chapter 8 is more like Chapter 7, where it's got a bunch of stuff going on in Twin Peaks, and there's stuff we can talk about, since assuming we record after that one, or maybe we'll record after a couple, but we'll be able to spend a little bit more time theorizing and talking about the various minutia going on in the show, since we have two less TV shows to talk about now.
And maybe I'll even work in a couple of my Twin Peaks impressions. I was carrying on a conversation with myself today. I was able to do the Gordon voice talking to the Dark Cooper. I'm not going to do it here, so don't ask. I do the Gordon voice surprisingly well. Dark Cooper, I go back and forth between okay and awful. So, because basically it's just doing the slow... Just slowing it down, because it's very, very... Anyway. All right, so that's it for Twin Peaks. I'm going to throw one more show into the mix that I'm going to talk about. I just finished watching the entire season 3 of Bloodline. And my advice for other people? Don't bother. Okay, so now that we've finished... I mean, it's a show that made me, I don't even know if it should have been two seasons, but at least the second season was actually kind of fun or tense. This season, it was okay at best, and then I heard a lot of people complaining about the final couple episodes. I've watched those final couple episodes now. I understand what their issues were with them. I'm not really disagreeing with them, per se. The penultimate... Usually we love penultimate episodes. For some reason, they chose to do a penultimate episode that felt like 95% of it was a dream, or you're not really sure of reality. Not the time to do an episode like that, people. Huh. And then the last episode, it kind of like, oh, is that it? Oh, okay, whatever. Yeah. That's my extended review of Bloodline season 3.
Oh, well,
so sorry, Jason. So me and Jason will not be covering season 3 of Bloodline in a summer podcast the way we did last summer. I don't need to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I guess I'll probably definitely never get around to watching any of it now. I'm just terrible when it comes to watching Netflix shows. I mean, I think I've only watched the first two seasons of House of Cards, the first season of Daredevil, and Jessica Jones. And I don't think I've watched any other Netflix original series. I think I'll end up watching the last couple seasons of Longmire when I get around to watching that, because I like that show a lot, and they did the last couple seasons of that.
Oh, my God, you never watched Peaky Blinders, that's right. Oh my God.
Nope, haven't done that, haven't done Stranger Things, haven't started Orange is the New Black. I always forget that it's there, and now I've been focusing on watching some older HBO shows while CJ is still paying for my HBO. So I'm going to, I've been working Oz and 6 Feet Under.
Okay, I'm not going to knock you on watching those, of course. I mean, two of my favorites. But Happy Valley, man, come on, Happy Valley. It's such a short episode commitment. Six episodes?
Well, yeah. Well, just, have to wait till this fall. I'm assuming once Game of Thrones is over, CJ is going to be too cheap to keep paying for HBO, and then I'll drop it for the winter, and then maybe I'll knock out some of these Netflix shows.
All right. I have a ton of Netflix stuff to catch up on as well, but... Different situation. Okay, let's wrap this up. I did not want this podcast to go on as long as it has, but let's finish it up now. So, y'all, if you enjoyed this podcast, you will enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. find the page, like the page, and join the conversation about shows like Twin Peaks and Better Call Saul and Fargo and so many others. You can also find us on iTunes, Serious TV Drama Podcast. You can subscribe to our feed there, as well as rate and review us. And finally, you can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. I'm toying with the idea of designing a shirt or two and putting it on Cafe Press just to make a few bucks, because I'm like broke as broke. If anyone has a job they want to give me, that'd be cool too. But I'm thinking about maybe coming up with a couple STVD t-shirts and putting them there.
I am the general manager of KFC now, so I can hire you for a low paying, thankless job if you want to move to, Wisconsin.
Yeah. If you could figure out a way I can work for KFC remotely from home, then maybe I can inspect pictures of chicken or something. All right. Well, it was great getting back together with you to cover these finales. We will get together soon enough to, at the very least, talk about the continuing episodes of Twin Peaks. And who knows, maybe we'll come up with a couple other things to talk about this summer. There are other shows coming back that are... Oh, have you seen the ads for Preacher? That is looking really good. I hope they're not tricking me, but I got a really good feeling about the second season of Preacher. I got to admit. So I'm kind of looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think last year, did we talk about the entire season at once with Kate, or did we do it in a couple segments? I don't remember what we did.
I feel like we... Did we do the entire season in one podcast, or we split it into two? I don't remember. I know Kay was part of it. Basically, it felt like the first season was just a gigantic prelude to get to this season. Because this season seems like they're just on the road and causing trouble while the evil cowboy is pursuing them and yada, yada, yada. It looks like it's going to be fun.
Hopefully this is cool. It won't be Lord of Beef or whatever the hell it was last year, but hopefully it'll be cool.
I still liked it.
Okay, well, all right, let's wrap her up. You wanted to be done 1 minute ago, so
I broke my law. All right, well,
damn it.
Good night, everybody out there, and good night, Dan.
Good night, Scott. Thank you.